Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Welcome to episode 35, The Other Mary Black. In today's episode, we're looking at the stories of everyday weavers. Our guest this episode is Mary Black, who learned to weave in the late 40s and has wonderful stories about how weaving has changed over the years. She also tells us a little bit about tamari, a Japanese method of embroidering balls that has become one of her current passions. In the final essay, Many Voices, Light Work, I describe a bold new plan I have for the future of Weavecast. First of all, I would like to report that I had an absolutely wonderful Thanksgiving. There was pie, homemade biscotti, mashed potatoes, and overall, way too much food. But some of it was vegan, so that didn't count, right? There's a whole group of friends who live too far away from our families to go back for Thanksgiving. So every year, Jenny brings us all together for a Thanksgiving potluck. Now, we're a diverse bunch, so Thanksgiving foods encompass a wide variety of cultures and traditions. But because we see each other every year, it's still a homecoming. This year, the kids were old enough that they went down into the playroom and we didn't see them for hours. It gave us adults a chance to talk about adult things like books we're reading and movies we've seen and how our writing is going. And in general, just catch up on what everybody's been doing lately. It was just wonderful. I want to thank everyone who sent comments and emails encouraging me to take a day off. Every single one made me smile. I'd also like to thank everyone who responded to my fundraising request last episode. Thanks to your generosity and a well-timed after Thanksgiving Day sale, the show was able to purchase some new equipment. We got a Zoom H2, which will both make it possible for me to do panel discussions, and it also provides a very portable way to gather recordings in the field. So thank you for helping out with that. In other news, there is a new team on Etsy, specifically for hand weavers. So if you sell on Etsy or you're considering selling on Etsy, you should look into that. They also have a Google group where they discuss ideas for how to better sell their items, as well as a Flickr group. There will be links to all of that on the show notes. And if you don't know about Etsy, it's a wonderful online craft bazaar where artists and people producing handmade goods can sell their stuff. And unlike eBay, it only allows either vintage items, handcrafted items, or supplies for creating handcrafted items. So it's really targeted to people looking for art. The Surface Design Association is having a conference May 28th through 31st in Kansas City, Missouri. Their theme this year is Off the Grid. So if you're interested in surface design, you might want to go check that out. There will be a link in the show notes. There's an exciting new blog online. Daryl Lancaster, who was our guest on episode 26, So You're Weaving, has just started a blog, and there will be a link to that as well in the show notes. Our sponsor this episode is Bonnie Tarsis, a wonderfully creative weaver who specializes in color. Bonnie teaches workshops in color horoscope weaving, woven words, and turned weft ikat, and now offers study-at-home kits. She blogs online as Weaving Spirit. This time of year, you start thinking about what you're thankful for. And one of the things I'm thankful for is all of you for listening to the show, for sharing this adventure with me, and for understanding that sometimes a mom just needs to take time off and be with her family. I'm going to play you a little song that expresses some of what I feel.
Fourth Thursday in November, I'm sure you all have heard, is when we offer thanks for stuff and devour roasted bird. But I'm not sure who I'm thanking. I'm not sure it's a him. And I'm not sure what's deliberate, accidental, or a whim. Then I thought perhaps generic thanks will cover every base. Random gratitude for everything might help me say some face. But it didn't seem appropriate, and it surely wasn't fair. Spouting platitudes anonymously into open air. So, thanks to Mom and Dad for having me. Because of you, I'm there. Though if you'd chosen differently, I guess I wouldn't care. Thanks to brother whom I fought with over who had cooler toys. Thanks to sister who still liked me even though she hated boys. Thanks to all the kids who beat me up because I was a nerd. And then asked for help with homework, which I offered undeterred. Thanks to the first girl I asked out, she said she liked my smile. I have so much to be thankful for, so this could take a while. Thanks to PopCap and Bethesda, cause your games are so much fun. Thanks Anne Hathaway and Kate Winslet for the topless scenes you've done. Thanks to all the pigs who've died to make my pulled pork barbecue. Thanks to Quentin Tarantino for Kill Bill 1 and 2. Thanks to J.K. Rowling for screwing up Harry Potter Volume 6. If she hadn't, I might not have found better written fanish fix. Thanks to Joel, Mike the Robots, Dr. F and TV's Frank. Bobo, Pearl, and Brain Guy, and I still have more to thank. Thank you to the Dutch who got annoyed at all the Puritans for saying public dancing was lewd. Thank you to the native tribes who welcomed all the pilgrims here, and sorry that you got so badly screwed. Thanks, Ben Franklin, though you didn't have much luck in getting folks to think that turkeys were okay. Thanks to the inventors of tofurkey and turducken. They're just an awful lot of fun to say. Thanks to those closest to me, my love and my best friends. I could go on for hours, but at some point this song ends. Thanks to everyone who listens to my music with delight. And if you don't keep listening, someday I'll get it right. Thanks to everyone who keeps me sane, you lovely bunch of loons. Making sure the voices in my brain are all from old cartoons. Last but not least, thanks Bill Dial and Mike Zinberg who gave me Turkeys Away on WKRP.
It's on WKRP in Cincinnati.
As God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly.
One of the requests I've gotten recently is to do more shows that tell the stories of everyday weavers, not just the weaving stars. It's always been my goal with Weavecast to tell everyone's stories. But the reason that I end up interviewing people who are book authors or well-known teachers is simply that they're easier to identify and often more willing to talk to me. When I approach everyday weavers, they sometimes don't want to do an interview because they don't think they have anything to say. Which is a shame, because the more I talk to people, the more I discover that everyone has a story to tell. Today's weaver is Mary Black, who started weaving in the late 40s, just as weaving was experiencing a resurgence in popularity. She was married to a man who took the family all over the country, and as a consequence, she ended up meeting a lot of interesting people in the weaving world. Several people suggested that I interview her for Weavecast, and with the help of some friends, I was finally able to set up this interview. As you listen to Mary's interview, I want you to think about this. When I approached Mary, she said, "Why would you want to talk to me? I don't have anything interesting to say." And then think about your own stories. You may not realize it, but I bet you have interesting things to say. I'm here in the house of Mary Black. One of the secret joys about doing Weavecast is getting to travel to weavers' houses because they are always filled with such beautiful textiles and interesting things. One of the first things I saw when I entered was this gorgeous wedge-woven rug on the floor in beautiful reds and maroons. So thank you, Mary, for taking the time to talk with us here.
Well, I have plenty of time.
I think that the first thing we should probably do is explain that although you are Mary Black, you're not...
I'm not the Mary Black.
Who wrote Key to Weaving.
The Mary Black lived in New York. When the machinery took over weaving, she kept the hand weaving using looms at home alive. That's what the Mary Black did for the weavers today.
Going through the weaving world with a name like Mary Black, what was that like?
It was fun because they'd look at me and they'd say, oh, did you write the book? And I said, no, I'm the other Mary Black. I met the Mary Black in New York. We were talking. I said, well, you know, they always come tell me, oh, you're the Mary Black who wrote the book. And I have to tell them, no, I'm the other one. And she said, well, you have my permission to write the book, Mary Black, by the other Mary Black.
You have autograph capabilities.
Yes, I was given permission by the Mary Black to autograph her book. And it was a kick because she was a dear, sweet woman. She died shortly after I left New York. I corresponded with her, but I didn't really know her as well as I wished I could have. But she did give me the permission. When people come up, I always signed it the other Mary Black, so they know I didn't write the book.
Well, I have to bring my new key to weaving to you to get an autograph. I didn't realize that was still possible.
Yeah, better come soon.
So if that's her story, how did you get started weaving?
I consider myself a spinner who weaves because I learned spinning first. My husband was transferred to New York. We had been tootling around Pennsylvania in Old Kutztown, and I went to a fair there, and there was this man spinning. I just sat down at his feet and watched him spin. I was absolutely, I couldn't believe that you could do this. And I sat there on the grass and finally looked at me and said, would thee like to spin? I said, oh, yes, but I don't have a spinning wheel. So he sent me to Mr. Claude Olt, who had a mill where they used to grind flour, and it had a water power, and he said he had a spinning wheel. And we went into this old grist mill. We went upstairs, and it was humongous. It was filled with every kind of spinning wheel that had ever been made. These were all antique wheels. I wanted one so bad, and we weren't exactly wealthy in those days. And then he said, well, I will pick one out for you. We walked around, and finally he picked out this one wheel. It's just a gorgeous wheel. And I said, great, how much is it? And he said, well, I could let you have it for $45. I thought, well, I think I can get that out of the food budget. So I gave him the $45 and we took it home. I got the book and I sat out on the porch in our house in New York and I spun rope. I had some wool that Mr. Olt had given me and I was trying to spin it. My youngest daughter came up and asked me what I was doing, and I said, well, I'm going to spin this and save it for posterity. And she looked at me and left. And pretty soon she came back and she says, Mom, you've got to make three of those. And I said, why do I have to make three of those? And she says, well, you've got three posterities, me and Beth and Jim. So every time now, the very first thing I make three of them so I can have them posterity pieces for the three kids.
So at this point, Mary had a spinning wheel. But how did she get her first loom?
I went into a Salvation Army store in New York looking for furniture for a friend who had just come from Sweden, and they had no furniture. And we walked out with a 24-inch Structo table loom. We didn't get her any furniture.
It sounds like you learned to weave about the time that American hobbyist hand weaving was having a resurgence.
Right. I learned at the Oyster Bay Historical Society. People would want to know how you did it. And I've never been known to keep my mouth shut. And if I know something, I'll tell you all about it, that everything I know. Anytime anybody wanted to know about weaving, why, they'd say, oh, I know a woman who weaves, she'll tell you. People would come because I knew how to do it, and I could tell them and get them started. And I taught in New York. Then we were transferred to Phoenix. I joined the Phoenix Desert Spinners and Weavers Guild. The following year, there was a weaving show in Las Vegas. A bunch of us from Phoenix wanted to go, so we piled in the car. My husband drove us up there. Little did he know. We were there, and I met Mr. LeClaire of the LeClaire Loom, and he happened to have one there. And I said, oh, that's such a beautiful loom. I wish I knew how to weave on it. And he said, oh, you can weave. I know you can do that. And Mr. LeClaire said, well, you can buy this when the show is over, and then I won't have to take it back to Canada. And I said, okay. And looked at my husband, and he said, oh, yes, I'll get it in the car. And I brought the loom home. I had woven before in New York on the little table loom, but I'd never had a great big 45-inch four-harness LeClaire, and I felt like I was really hot stuff. So I did weaving and spinning there. Then we moved to San Francisco. We lived there for about 20 years, and I taught weaving and spinning there. And then we came back to Seattle because my husband was from Seattle, and my kids were here. Without weaving, without fibers, I would have been lost, because all I had to do was go in to wherever we lived at the time and say, well, I weave or I spin. And nobody spun in those days. And they wanted me to come and spin and show people how to spin. So I would spin. And spinning is the joy of my life. As you can tell with all of the stacks, I've got cashmere in there that I just got that I'm just dying to get to. I've got wool in all of the little buckets that are supposed to hold firewood in there. They're full of wool. Everybody has their stashes, and my stash is spinning fibers. That's what I do mostly now. I'm not doing as much weaving as I used to do, but I do spend at least an hour or two every day. We were sent here to Seattle on my husband's business, and we were here for a little bit. And I joined the Seattle Weavers Guild then. We were transferred, but I loved the Seattle Weavers Guild. I just loved the people. And I had made friends with Virginia Harvey.
How did you meet Virginia?
We went to the Bellevue Fair that they have every year. Virginia was there with her macrame book. And I had just read an article about macrame in the McCall's magazine that they used to have. And I walked over and I said, oh, you're doing macrame. And Virginia looked at me and she says, you know what it is? It was just like we had known each other forever. I lived in San Francisco at the time. And she lived on Whidbey Island. And so we corresponded. And then lo and behold, my husband got transferred to Seattle. I went over and visited with Virginia and just happened to find a house on Whidbey Island. We bought a house there. And Virginia and I saw each other every day. We were just together all the time. whenever there was anything, why I'd drive and we'd go wherever it was if it had to do with fiber.
I never had the pleasure of meeting Virginia Harvey. Can you tell me what kind of woman she was?
Virginia was a researcher. She worked at the university and set up their library. All of the great museums used her method of storing rugs and fabrics. And she wrote books. She was just smart. It was such a joy because living there on Whidbey, we became great buddies. People would come to her house because they'd heard of Virginia. And we had the group that got together at her house, and we called ourselves the Brady Bunch because we were all studying braids. She was very interested in braids because she was using the braids to make this space tether. She worked oh so hard to do this one braid for this. It had to have 9 different intersections. Can she work this out? It was way beyond me. I just held the thread. And then she made, there's a fellow down in Portland who worked for Nike. And he wanted to make some shoes using a particular braid that she had developed. And Mike came up and we would meet with him.
I heard you were on the ground when HGA was formed. What was that like?
Well, we were in Las Vegas, the bunch of us, and when I got my first loom. And there was Virginia Harvey and myself and 2 gals from California whose name are completely left my mind right at this minute. We decided that we had to have conferences.
So out of that, HGA was formed. And Mary Black ended up being the program chair for the second official Convergence, which was held in San Francisco.
Convergence was really a wonderful, wonderful experience. I was program chairman, and I just went through the old Hand Weaver and Craftsman magazines and got names, and I wrote them letters and said, we're having a Convergence, and we would like for you to come and teach, and we can't pay you anything. But we will pay your way here and your lodging. And they all came. They were delighted to come. And we had the Convergence at the St. Francis Hotel in San Francisco. And afterwards, we had workshops at Mills College. Now, I sound like I did the whole thing, and I didn't. I was just the program chairman. I just had the nerve enough to write all of these people and tell them what we were doing and would they like to do it. And they did. And that was the first Convergence. No. Or the second Convergence. The first one was in Detroit and then the second one was in San Francisco.
One of the weavers that Mary encouraged to teach at the second Convergence was Sarah Natani. And Mary told me some wonderful stories about meeting Sarah and her interactions with Navajo weavers on the reservation. But I've saved those stories for a future upcoming show that is all about Navajo weaving.
Well, I'd like to talk to you a little bit now about Tamari.
Oh, okay.
Can you tell me?
Not today, but Tamari.
I see this basket full of beautifully colored, intricately designed balls.
It's a Japanese art. And I saw them in San Francisco. I saw the Tamari ball, and I was utterly fascinated. And I went to Japantown in San Francisco, and I saw a book. And I said, oh, getting into trouble again. I have more darn books that turn me on to something. And I bought the book. And it's all in Japanese. And I finally made a Tamari ball. I learned how to do it. What they basically are is rice hulls that you put in a ball, in a sack, and you wrap it with yarn. And then after you wrap it in yarn and get it round, then you wrap it with sewing thread. and to for the color that you want to use. And then after you use the, you see this is the sewing thread wrapping. And then you divide the ball geometrically. And it's plain math. And how it got me, I don't know, because I am not a mathematician in any way, shape, or form. But you divide your ball into many different ways. And you see, they're basically the same designs, but the way you use your color, and this is what gets me, is the way the colors develop, the way you can add and do things with the colors. And it's nothing but pearl cotton.
They look as intricate as snowflakes.
This is the Tamari thread that you can buy in Japan Center. It's a rayon thread, and it comes round, and then you pull it out so it wrinkles up, and that's what gives it the texture. Let's see, this one is pearl cotton. It gives it a little different look, a little different texture.
Yeah, the pearl cotton is smoother, and the other one is more, like you said, more wrinkled and textury. Yeah. These look so intricate. Are they hard to do?
They are basic geometry. If you can divide a ball in half, and then you divide it in half again, then you wrap what you can see on this one, the red colors. That's a guide thread. And then you go from point to point.
You have pins?
You put pins in, yeah, to tell you where you are. And then you use a needle, and you run underneath the thread, and you do. It's all done with a needle.
Oh.
And they're very simple, and they are the most fun. They are very, very addictive.
Do they take a long time to make?
This guy is the easiest one. And you can make that in probably 2 hours.
Wow. This one that I'm holding that she's talking about, it's a red center ball, and then it looks like a flower blossom on the top.
On each one. And one, each end is done differently. You see a different progression of the greens. Exactly the same, but it looks so different.
Yeah, on one, you're starting with the dark green and going to yellow, and on the other one, you're starting with the yellow and going out to the dark green. This one looks like it's not finished yet. You got a pin there? Am I right? Or
no, I may have just gone by and stuck a pin in it because I picked up a pin. I just have them all over the place because sometimes I feel like doing them and sometimes I don't.
In Japan, what are the tamari balls used
These
for?
These are put by the daughter's bed on for them to find it when they wake up on New Year's Day.
Oh.
That's the story I was told.
Okay.
So they are for, a mother makes them for their daughter as a very special gift for the new year. They're fun. I've made hundreds of them. If you're old, you get one designed with a turtle on it because the turtle is the significance of honoring your elder. I haven't made my turtle yet. You just get started and you can't stop.
So if somebody wanted to learn this, how would you recommend they go about it?
Get a book.
Like you did.
If they have a yen to, you can get the books in the Japanese stores down Japantown. Or call me. I'll teach anybody tomorrow.
Okay, I'm going to do this for the mic. What's that?
The secret is you put a noisemaker on the inside. Never found out why they did it, but you're supposed to. And what I do is put two bottle caps together and put some rice in it and tape it.
What are you building your ball on? Because I mean, I know most people use styrofoam.
Well, that one is styrofoam.
So how'd you get the thing on the inside?
You
just cut a hole?
Cut a hole.
Oh.
Put it in. This one, you can feel the difference. This is rice hulls.
So this one is the old traditional.
Yeah, that's the old traditional way. Yeah.
The hulls and the bag and the special yarn. And it is beautiful.
Well, they're very easy to make. The books are a little bit hard to understand if you've never made them before. But after you make one, the use of color, God, it's so much fun. You get the tamari thread in little packets like this. Their range of color is just glorious. But you don't have to use that. You can use the pearl cotton because you got a beautiful range of colors there.
when you say rice hulls, you mean like the rice chaff?
Yeah.
Like the stuff you would normally throw away.
Yeah. They use it to feed horses.
Oh.
And feed cattle. And
I wondered how it got started because I knew they didn't have styrofoam balls in ancient Japan.
You can use newspaper. Just wad it up.
Just anything you can make a circle out of.
Make a circle. If you want to start out this big, because it will go in, but I'll show you the joy.
Oh my goodness. Okay, I'm going to describe this just because people are not getting a visual. This is a soccer ball sized tamari ball. It is amazing.
I found this styrofoam ball and I thought, oh, it would make a gorgeous tamari. I used one of those full cones of white sewing thread over white yarn. You wrap the ball and to make a base to stitch in. I used a full cone of white sewing thread.
Oh my goodness.
To wrap this. And it took me days and days and days to do it. I made it and I just love it. I think the colors and everything are just gorgeous. And I had it sitting by the fireplace.
Oh no.
And it was the cold winter and over on Whidbey. And I went over after the cold left. And I went to pick it up, and this had all melted. So I can put it down. Nobody can tell. But I'm going to say, if you're going to make something this big, don't put it next to the fireplace.
Right.
It's very easy to make. This is the easiest pattern, really.
That's a beautiful pattern.
So you divide your ball into five and interlace them.
What keeps the little points from not moving in? Is that stitched down?
It's stitched because you put yarn down first and then you...
Oh, you stitch into it.
And you stitch into that, not into the styrofoam, but into just that underlying layer of yarn. All of these are like that, except these are stuffed with rice hulls.
It's too bad you can't put a needle and inject in something in there that would poof it back up.
Well, it doesn't show if you put it down right.
That's true.
Tamari, I think the thing that I enjoy the most is the use of color. I try and make one a year for the girls. They're just great fun.
Since you've been in weaving for such a long time, how have you seen it evolving from when it was first resurging to present day?
It's become more technical. The loving hands at home weaving, like placemats, that's what we did mostly, and rugs. We were great rug weavers. And now it's gotten so technical that you have to be a mathematician and you just don't have the hands-on approach, I don't think. Everything evolves technically.
You mean like the computerized?
Yeah, the computerized stuff. And I'm sorry, I don't... Computerized is too much of a machine. It doesn't have the feeling in the weaving that you get when you do it by hand, so to speak. It doesn't have maybe just a little skip thread. It's all perfect. And you knew a machine do it, but when you have something that's hand woven, you know that somebody put the time and the effort and love doing it. You don't weave for profit. You don't weave but for your own joy, and it is one of the most joyful thing you can do. And there's so many kinds of weaving. You've got tapestry weaving, and that's fun, and you have your loom weaving, you have inkle weaving. There's just all of the little different kinds of weaves that they did a long time ago when they had to do it because there was nothing else. There's nothing better than having hand-woven shoelaces. If you think about it, how did you do your shoes 100 years ago? You wove the laces so you could tie them on. I prefer the hand-on thing rather than the machine weaving. And that's why I love tapestry.
Thank you.
Today's audio essay is Mini Voices, Light Work. Every day around noon, I go for a half-hour walk. I do this to keep healthy, but I also find that just by getting up away from the computer and out in the fresh air, I get inspirations that wouldn't otherwise occur to me. Yesterday, as I was walking and thinking about Weavecast, I had a breakthrough, and something I had been trying to figure out was suddenly clear as crystal. Before I tell you about my idea, I want to talk a little bit about the beginnings of Weavecast. When I first started Weavecast, it was on a whim. I'd been listening to knitting podcasts and just gotten fired up about knitting and was enthused about this new medium for exchanging information and ideas. And I found that the more knitting podcasts I listened to, the more I wanted to knit. But being more of a weaver than a knitter, I wanted a weaving podcast. And because one didn't exist, I decided to create one. Now, at that time, that was a really audacious thought because I had absolutely no experience in audio recording and editing. And it was very daunting at first to learn everything. But I had that fire in the belly. I wanted there to be a weaving podcast. And as I started to learn, I found out that it really was quite easy and much simpler than I had imagined. So easy, in fact, that there are over 100,000 people creating podcasts right now. And although I started with no experience and some free software and a used mic I got off of eBay, it was the doing it that taught me everything I needed to know. And now I have a pretty good body of knowledge about how to produce a show. And if you compare the early episodes of Weavecast to the more current ones, you'll see how far the show has come. In the beginning of Weavecast, one of my biggest fears was that I wouldn't have enough to talk about to do a monthly hour-long show. I was also terrified that I wouldn't be able to get guests to come be on the show. Well, since then, Weavecast has grown to be a strong voice in the weaving community. And instead of having trouble finding stories, people are giving me story ideas all the time. Wonderful things that I wish I could follow up on. But because there's just one of me, I can't. And in fact, I have 14 wonderful interviews. I've talked to Alice Schlein about network drafting and Bobby Irwin on iridescence and Kay Fassett about using color in weaving. Really wonderful interviews that are awaiting production. And some of them are months old at this point, which isn't fair to the listeners because they're not getting to hear these wonderful interviews. And it's not fair to the guests that they have to wait so long for their interviews to air. But it's all I can do as one person. Last episode, I talked about bringing on audio interns to help me edit some audio. And I even went as far as to contact a local community college and get the forms to fill out to start a formalized internship program. But I could never bring myself to fill out the forms, and it was on this walk that I realized why. When you edit audio, you have to make subjective judgments about what's important and what's not. And the thought of a college student who was just looking for another bullet point on their resume, listening to these interviews that in many cases represent the oral tradition of hand weaving, and deciding what's important and what could be cut, it just didn't sit right with me. I would prefer to have weavers making those decisions, people who care about the content and people who know what other weavers would consider important. So, the realization I had on my walk was maybe Weavecast should be more than one person. What if Weavecast was an ensemble? Not just Sign Mitchell's voice, but a lot of voices. I'm inviting people to work with me on Weavecast. I would love to create a fun, interactive online group that shared ideas for new stories, talked about audio editing, and brainstormed ways to make Weavecast better. Here are some of the reasons why it would be great to join the Weavecast ensemble. We could get some of these wonderful stories that are not currently able to be produced done. There are amazing weavers all over the country, all over the world,
that we could reach out to that I'm not able to do by myself. And we could do more timely reporting, talk about events and conferences. A side benefit, if we had more than one person working on the show, we could do the weekly Weavecast that I've been trying to figure out how to get done since the very beginning. Folks who worked on the ensemble would be gaining experience and a new marketable skill. Who knows? It might lead to a new passion that took you in a completely different direction in your career. Even if you're not interested in the job market, it's a great way to exercise your brain by learning something new. Everyone who works in the ensemble will get credit on the show, so it's a wonderful way to gain exposure to the weaving community and a wonderful way to give something back. If you've enjoyed the show and you have time, it's a way to help set the future direction of Weavecast. The people on the ensemble, as I envision it, would collectively determine what shows got produced. By being a part of that, you get to have a say in what Weavecast reports on. And most of all, I think the most compelling reason to consider joining this ensemble is to have fun. Producing a podcast is such a thrill. And there are so many different ways to contribute. If you are the kind of person who likes to go out and talk to people, once we get this backlog of interviews worked through, I'll be looking for people to help interview, especially since I've got the Pacific Northwest pretty well covered, but there's so many wonderful weavers on the East Coast and overseas that it would be great to have remote reporters interviewing those folks. But if you're not the kind of person who ever wants to hear your voice on the radio, there's a lot of help that could be done by editing audio. And editing audio is not hard, but it's as simple as listening to the person's voice and looking at waveforms. It's just a graphical depiction of what the voice is doing. And then you just cut. It's just cut and paste. If you can read a Word document and cut out words, you have all the skills you need to edit audio. Down the road, I'd also love to find people who were willing to take on guest hosting an entire episode of Weavecast. Because after doing this for 3 years, it would be lovely to be able to take the occasional month off and not have Weavecast miss an episode. So if this has sparked your imagination, if you've always been curious about how making a podcast comes together, or you've dreamed about doing your own podcast but don't know where to get started, get in touch. You can participate as much or as little as you want. The whole point of opening this up is that so everyone can share the work and no one has to do it all. Many voices, light work. Come be a part of the Weavecast ensemble and get your voice heard. That's all for this episode. And now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to finish your holiday gifts. It's cold and there's snow outside and I have a 5-year-old son. This song explains what we'll be doing next week while he's out of school.
It's 7 a.m., it's snowing again. There's no school, dare I say amen. We're going outside, the ground is so white. Let's get into a snowball fight. We'll each make a fort that we'll hide behind. I am gonna get you this time. You throw with your left, I throw with my right. Let's get into a snowball fight. If this were another kind of fight, Mom would just explode like dynamite. There's no bombs and there is not a knife, just a snowball. We're all bundled up to play in the snow. I am gonna nail you, you know. I'll aim for the spot that ain't covered right. Let's get into a snowball fight. Just a snowball. It's 7 a.m., it's snowing again. There's no school, dare I say amen. We're going outside, the ground is so white. Let's get into a snowball fight.
Weavecast is made possible through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Mary, Fran, Barbara, Kathleen, Gina, Ush, Brucie, Jenny, Dorothy, Susan, and the Washington Spinners and Weavers Guild. At a time when money is tight and even NPR is having to lay off staff and cut shows, your support means a lot. Our sponsor this episode is Bonnie Tarsis, a wonderfully creative weaver who specializes in color. Bonnie teaches workshops in color horoscope weaving, woven words, and turned weft ikat, and now offers study-at-home kits. She blogs online as Weaving Spirit, and there will be a link to that in the show notes. Our musical guests this episode are Tom Smith with his song, So Thanks, and TV's Kyle with Snowball Fight. Cost Cut Japan with Reggae Far East was our ambient music.